Good evening. Welcome. Oh, it was so nice to look around the room. See, friends old and new. So last week, there was a nice discussion that we had here about kind of what brings us here. The question was posed from the seat, you know, why do we come and what do we do when we're sitting quietly on our cushions facing the wall? And I'm not going to ask you to do it again, don't worry, but we went around the room and each person actually shared very nicely and very authentically what their our answers to those questions. And, you know, some people said they come here for community. Some people said they come here for insight. Some people said they come here for just the physicality. One person said, I come here because of this room. My body needs to be in this room, you know. So I think that there's a variety of different experiences that we have here. And so I'd like to share a bit about more about all that. I want to start with a quote. This is by a teacher, Dainin Katagiri, who was died maybe a while ago, not too long ago. He's a contemporary teacher, basically. And he described Zazen, which is, of course, the seated meditation that we do here, as more than a meditation posture and more than any set of particular techniques, which we might think sometimes when we first come here, if we have Zazen instruction, we tend to focus on, you know, how you come in the room, how you get on your cushion, and it sounds a bit maybe like it's a technique or it's a posture, and it is those things, but it's more than that. And he says what it's not. He says it's not a way to escape from life by being mindful of something that is apart from the human world. He says it is the practice of being present in the real stream of time and looking directly at life itself. Zazen enables you to plunge below the surface and leads you to touch the core of your life. So I'd like to talk about those words. We'll see where we go. Being present in the real stream of time and looking directly at life itself. You know, so often we want to not be where we are. Oh, I want to be anywhere other than where I am. This is uncomfortable. I don't like it. I don't like what's going on. And of course, we make effort to change things. That's good. It's good to make effort to change, to try to have things move in a more positive direction or to address wrongs, things like that. It's very important. And yet, when we're sitting Zazen, what we're practicing is to be present with the real stream of time and looking directly at life itself. And what that means is this very life. I'm sorry, but that's what it means. Your life. This one. Not the one that's going to happen when you have more money or you have a better relationship or you have a better job or that person dies or, you know, whatever. This real stream of time, looking directly at this life itself. So, boy, that's a tall order. What does that take to actually be able to have the ability to just sit and be present with this life? I don't know about how it is for you, but my main obstruction is the little voice in my head. Maybe others of you have different kinds of obstructions. There are different kinds of obstructions. Sometimes the physical body itself is an obstruction, you know, or the heart, the emotions. For me, it's absolutely and definitely the incessant commentary of the little voice in my head that tricks me into thinking that that's reality. It tricks me into thinking that I'm supposed to listen to it, and that I'm supposed to believe it, and that I'm supposed to act upon its pronouncements and its judgments. So, what are we supposed to do with that little voice in the head? Well, if you read and study any of the Zen teachings in the Zen school, basically we are encouraged to, well, there's many things they suggest we do with it, but the one I like the best is the teachings about releasing the grip of grasping mind. You know, on one way, we are encouraged to have compassion for it, not to try to cut it out and be mad at it, because it's us. I heard Reb Anderson say one time, it's your family. It's like you don't want to be in your family, but you can't escape your family. That little mind, that's your family. Our delusions, that's our family. So, and it's what makes us who we are. We spend most of our time listening and dealing with that little voice. So it's a huge part of who we are, whether we're blindly following it or whether we're trying to liberate ourselves from its dominance. We're intimate. It's an intimate companion. So we want to be kind with our intimate companions, but we don't necessarily have to let them run our lives. There's a wonderful teacher who, I'm not remembering his name right now, but he wrote a book called The Untethered Soul, and he talks about that little voice as our roommate. And he invites us to consider if you had a roommate who said to you all the things that that little voice says, how would you feel about that roommate? I don't know about you, but for me, I'd be pretty much like wanting that roommate to move out. So this is the side of, okay, I can study you, I can be compassionate about you, but actually I would like to be free from being dominated by you, and therefore I have to do something. There's some agency here. I actually have to study what it is, how it works, what makes it come up, really get to know it, and then be willing to release it. This is what we mean in the vow, I think, of ending delusion. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. This is the ending aspect of it. I wrote something recently. I've been sitting and practicing for 30 years, and I'm still studying this. So if you're newer and you're feeling discouraged, like, oh man, I don't think I'm ever going to be able to release the grip of my grasping mind, this is an endless practice. So please be encouraged. I'm still studying this stuff. But I'm getting better at it. I am getting better at it. I am. Hallelujah. Because I study it. I do. I take this teaching seriously. Dogen says to study delusion. So I study delusion. My root teacher, Catherine, told me when I was first starting practice, I said, what should I study, Catherine? She said, study your divided mind. Study the aggression of your ego. Man. That's what she said. So it's like, okay, teacher, I will. And there's some interesting things to learn. So one of the things I'm learning is, many, many things. But one thing I learned is that, I don't know if everybody has this tendency, but I do, and my lineage, my ancestors have this lineage of something that I think Eckhart Tolle called the pain body. That we, you know, there's a way that we carry this pain in our body. And I mean, for me, it's not even something that I necessarily created. I was born into it. My immediate ancestors had a lot of difficulties in their life. They were dirt poor. They were in war. They had psychological difficulties, and it was hard. It was really hard for them. So their bodies carried a lot of pain. And when I was a little kid, when I was a baby, they passed it on to me. You know, it wasn't anybody's fault. Nobody did anything wrong. Just sort of got born into it, right? And it's taken me a long time, but I've actually, over time, been able to come to know it, feel it, and learn that the voice that likes to activate it, and actually learn that there's also a pleasure body. This is something that we don't always think about. Pain and pleasure kind of go together. And some people, I guess, are born into the pleasure body. I was too. But somehow the pain body had got to dominate for many, many years. And so what I notice now, as I can see the old mind that likes to aggravate and create and solidify the pain body, and as I come to know the pleasure body, and oh, there's a mind that can also source that. And that's a mind that actually opens to, oh, what feels good here, rather than what's wrong. Where's the opening? Instead of contracting, where's the opening? Where's the feeling of ease? What's nourishing? That's the pleasure body. Oh, I think I'll pay attention to that too. And what's the mind that encourages that body to be alive? So learning to make distinctions, I think, is part of this proposal to study our little mind in service of liberation. So, let's see, I just wrote this. This is from a journal, I don't know, a couple months ago. I can feel my old mind trying to butt in and make me pay attention to its objects of thought. It wants me to agitate the pain body. So this is another thing that I came to recognize, and this is something from the Buddha's teaching that, you know, I just had to discover it for myself, is our mind makes objects out of our thoughts. We think they're real, but they're not. They're just objects that our minds make up. They make up these stories, objects of thought. So I can feel my old mind trying to butt in and make me pay attention to its objects of thought, trying to agitate the pain body. But my practice now is to focus on the flow and to be able to separate enough from these objects of thought to see them as just that. Oh, these are just objects of thought that my habit mind is creating. But actually, I don't need to grasp onto them. What I could actually turn my attention to is what's flowing. What's alive right now? And can I relax into that? And that is what is called genjo, moment-to-moment actualization. So one of the things I think we can pay attention to when we're thinking about this kind of thing is, what is the content of your consciousness? That's a question that can help kind of open up when you want to, if you want to, you don't have to. I don't recommend this to anybody, but if you want to, it can be very fruitful. And so one of the things to pay attention to is listen to your mind. What's the content of your consciousness? What are you putting in to be your subject matter? That's a little bit of a hint about how your own internal mechanism is working. Because the content of our consciousness can be these objects of thought. It can be these stories about our pain body or our pleasure body, but the content of consciousness can also be, what is it right now that is flowing? And I think this is what Katagiri is talking about when he says that Zazen is the practice of being present in the real stream of time. Plunging below the surface. I think the surface is where those objects of thought live, the familiar, habitual. But actually, Zazen can invite us to plunge below that surface and start to inquire and experience and explore. Poke around. What else is there? What other kinds of content might my consciousness have if not being obsessed with these objects of thought? So, so I think there's these two aspects so far that I'm wanting to point out, draw to our attention. There's the side that's about releasing something, letting go of something, but there's also the sides that's about letting ourselves be filled and nourished. Do you feel the difference there? I mean, that was a big insight for me when I realized, because I was so much focused on letting go, and we're taught that, let it go, just let it go. And sometimes you're like, I can't let it go. That's not helping. That's not helping. Well, another thing to think about then, rather than letting go, is this opening to be nourished and to connect with the dynamic flow. I think sometimes too in Zen, and I say this with great respect for all these practices that we do, but I think sometimes we overly favor trying to use the mind to free ourselves from the mind. So we have these awesome teachings, truly awesome, the Diamond Sutra, the Yogacara, Dogen telling us to study the self, our teachers telling us to study our divided mind, to study the aggression of our ego. All these things are still in the realm of mind. And we even say, use mind to liberate yourself from mind. And again, I'm not saying I don't agree with that. I'm not saying that I don't practice that. But I do want to kind of stake my claim here that I believe there's other domains than the mind. And sometimes the mind is not the domain that we're going to experience liberation through. And I don't know if that's heresy or not, but that's my dharma. And I've come to it honestly and through hard labor on the cushion. And if you've been around me for any period of time, you'll know where I'm going with this. I always see a wheel that has mind and spirit and heart and body. And sometimes, and to me, the indicator for when it's time to shift is if what you're doing isn't working for you. I mean, we do honor and revere, and certainly I myself have practiced the thing where you just keep doing something for 30 years, and then finally one day you have an opening and you get free. But I think there's also something beneficial too. If you keep doing it, you keep trying it, and you're not experiencing more ease, and you're not experiencing liberation, I think it's fine to shift tactics and do something different. Do something different. So, for example, if we were going to use this model of mind, heart, spirit, and body, I'd say, okay, sometimes you have to drop down. Get out of here and go down, down, down. Where? Down. Oh, what am I feeling right now? Not what am I thinking, not what are my objects of mind telling me, not what the little voice is saying, not what a Zen say to do. Oh, what's the right thing to do? What would a good Buddhist do? What would a good practitioner? No, just go down and feel it. What are you feeling in your body? Where is it? Is it hot? Is it cold? Is it tight? Is it in your heart? Is it like an aching feeling in your heart? Is it like your gut is twisted? Is it a feeling of spaciousness? Do you feel like your pelvic floor is like as big as the whole universe? Can you feel your spine? Can you feel the energy going up and down your spine? Can you feel how the energy comes from up here and goes down through your spine and goes down through your butt and goes down into the earth? What about that? And I would offer to you that sometimes that can be where our liberation unfolds, is just stop thinking about it and access other domains, the domain of the heart, the domain of the body, and of course, one that I've been preaching here for the last 6 months or so, the domain of great nature, which is another direction we can go. So I think sometimes, go in, try to work it out, but sometimes go down, and sometimes go out. Sometimes our liberation can come from out, something that's bigger than me. This is where vow comes in. This is part of, I think, why in our Bodhisattva Mahayana orientation to Zen, that's the power of vow. Something that's bigger than your little particular complaint of the day that can help to kind of shake you out of the dream of whatever your story is and remember that there's something that's actually bigger than you, than any of us as individuals. So the Bodhisattva vows, which we chant at the end of lecture, can serve in that way. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it. Or maybe you have other vows. I mean, this is something in the secular world that certainly can serve a transformational function. You know, I had many, many times in my career as a professional facilitator working with groups who were, usually they were struggling when they called me and they didn't usually want to pay me to come and watch their proficiency and their functionality. They usually wanted me to come and help when they were struggling. And I saw time and again how it's possible that groups of people who are struggling can remember, oh, remember we're doing this because of the benefit of the kids. Oh, right, right. Oh, we're doing this because we have a bigger shared aspiration, something that matters to us, that we need to rise to the occasion to orient ourselves towards this bigger goal, vision, purpose, mission. So there's this aspirational part of looking up, and I think that there's also the part of just one of the best ways to relieve suffering. Help somebody else with their suffering. I think that's one of the best ways to relieve suffering. Look around. You see anybody who needs anything? Go over there and extend your hand and see if there's something that you could do. So there's the working in the mind to understand your little process and try to release the grip. There's the going to the heart, going down. There's going to spirit, we could say, kind of going out, going up. And then, of course, there's the body. And Catherine, our root teacher, was a great teacher of that approach of going into the body for our grounding and our liberation. This felt sense of truth that lives in the somatic realm that I think in our culture we acknowledge often. We talk about a gut feeling, we talk about hunches, we talk about intuition. That's not very honored so much in our culture. It's kind of poo-pooed. You know, somehow it's weak, or I don't know why people have this attitude about it, but it's kind of denigrated. You know, like if you're not being intellectual enough, if you're listening to your gut. But, ooh, I think, how many times have you wished that you did listen to your gut? I don't think it lies. I think this is the part where Katagiri is talking about how Zazen invites us to plunge below the surface and leads you to touch the core of your life. I think this somatic awareness of what we feel to be true in our deep body, mind, heart is touching the core of our life. I wanted to share a little story with you about a time that happened for me. It happened quite a while ago, but I've always remembered it because it was so powerful and yet it was so simple. And it was a time when I was really just kind of coming into the fullness of my career as a consultant, as a facilitator. And it was right at the same time when the dot-com boom was happening over the hill at Silicon Valley. And my clients were nonprofit people and educators. And a lot of my friends were going and working with the startups and were starting to make a lot of money. And it was very flashy and very exciting. And so they were telling me, you should really come over and check this out. You know, stock options, oh my God, they're insane. You know, it's really, really exciting. So I thought, oh, okay, well, maybe I should check it out. So I have this book that I've been part of writing, The Facilitator's Guide to Participatory Decision Making. I was pretty proud of that. Put it in my briefcase, went over and went with my friend and met her boss. And we had a conversation in his office, and he was telling me about all the great things they're doing. And I kind of showed him the book, and he said, I don't read books anymore. You know, kind of brushed it aside, you know, reading, ah, that's really old school, you know. So I'm kind of like, oh, okay, whatever. Anyhow, the week after that, I was driving down Highway 5 on a solo road trip heading for the Owens Valley, which is something that I do, especially at this time. I had just worked 56 days straight, and I was really, really, really torn up with this question of, should I go corporate? I mean, am I a fool to be, you know, just swimming in these little small pools of these little boards and not getting paid very much? Maybe I really should consider this corporate path. You know, it sounds kind of exciting. So I was driving down Highway 5, you know, thinking about this stuff and listening. At that time, it was CDs. I didn't have an iPod yet. I don't think they'd been existed, but I was listening to a Pete Seeger CD. And it was a song called about Uni Leadbetter, or Leadbelly, who was a singer who also did a lot of time in prison. He had a hard, hard living life. And he was a musician. And I'll sing it for you, the verse that that got me. So, you know, he part of the song, you know, he's long time gone, but his songs live on. So he had this particular verse that says, for years to come they would tell the tale of how Uni Leadbetter sang his way out of jail, saying, if I had you, Governor, like you got me, I'd wake up in the morning and I'd set you free. And I just, tears, just, if I had you, Governor, like you got me, I'd wake up in the morning and I'd set you free. And it was like, there's no decision to be made. My work is to serve those who are directly relieving suffering. That's my work. And there was no decision to be made. I never looked back. And for the next, I don't know, 20 years, those were my clients, the people who were working to teach and heal and feed and empower others. And that's not to say that you can't do good work in the corporate environment. I'm not wanting to set up a either or situation. But the thing for me was that this was a moment of truth that arose from the somatic depths of my body. And it wasn't just my personal body, but it was also my relationship with the larger body of social justice, the connection between poverty and prison, and also being a creative, being an artist, being somebody who in any circumstance is going to be creating. I mean, I've always been really moved by people who can't not sing. You know, he sang his way out of jail. So all of those things were resonating in my body. And I would offer to you that I think that is also what is meant by this practice of being present in the real stream of time and looking directly at life itself, plunging below the surface and touching the core of your life and letting yourself be touched by the truth of your life. And then acting on that, acting accordingly. And then there's the last part I want to bring up before I open it up is another part of it is just the part about acceptance. And that one can be hard for me. You know, I'm a doer. I'm a kind of, I like to take initiative and have a positive attitude and try to make things happen. And, you know, sometimes part of this practice of accepting the truth of our life is that we have to just accept, learn to accept what is, even as we're working for change. Just living. You know, if we have dilemmas that we're struggling with, just living that dilemma. Recognizing that maybe there's something that we can't figure out, that won't be figured out. That it's just something that we have to live. And then we might be surprised years later when we find out that actually we didn't know that the thing that we wanted to have happen was actually happening the whole time. But we didn't know it because we were fixing on imagining it should look a certain way. I've had that experience I've been working on this book as part of what I'm reading from here. I mean, I've been working on it for like 15 years, and I really started to doubt myself a lot in that process because I thought I was just being a fool. I was just being an idiot, you know. No one's ever going to want to read this. I don't even know what I'm saying. It's all been said before. I don't even know what I'm talking about. But somehow I just kept doing it. Somehow I just kept doing it. I just had to keep doing it. It was what I cared about. It was what I wanted to write about. It was what I wanted to think about. And so I just kept going. I just kept going. And then actually realized at a certain point that, I'll read this. I'll just read this rather than talking about it. I'll read it. How many times in the process of writing this book through its various permutations over the years have I criticized myself for how long it's taken to get this expression committed to paper and releasing it out into the world? God willing. That's not in there. And here I am now in my mid-60s. Will it ever happen? Is it too late? And yet, standing in a circle of devoted companions in the Gros Ventre wilderness not long ago, I was finally able to declare, as I stood before them, not only not disparaging how long it's taken for me to step into my fruition, and not only not worrying that I'm too old, and that I've wasted my time and that I will die before my gifts are fully manifest, but actually receiving the truth from mystery that it's taken 40 years because that's how long it's taken to mature this offering. I realize that even though I've judged myself for being a dilettante who jumps from one career path to the other and thus will never really have anything substantial to contribute in any one field, the truth is that this non-traditional, non-linear path is my priest path. And my content is the integration of every single thing that's happened on this journey. This is my dharma. My expression of my understanding of awakening and interdependence as manifested through my actual life experience. To be one who teaches from the sacred wound, I have had to be completely wounded. To be one who can offer healing to others, I have had to know intimately both the nature of joy and the nature of pain. And so I've come to slowly accept that this is my actual life. Not the one I'm going to live some other day. Not the one that should have been different than the one I've got. To reverse Suzuki Roshi's famous quote, it's true that I still need some improvement, and I'm perfect and things are perfect just as they are. So, and yet, you know, you have to go through the journey. And this is the thing. This is that teaching of, you know, first there is a mountain, and then there is no mountain, and then there is. It's like I could have stood 30 years ago and read what I think I, whatever my insights are that I have now, and gone, oh, yeah, I knew that. But I didn't really, because I hadn't lived it. We have to live it, you know. Our practice and realization happens through living our life. And, you know, so in that way, you can start off with some ideas, the first mountain, think, oh, yeah, I know, interdependence and non-duality and all that. But then you have to go through actually the blood and the sweat and the tears and the guts and the joy and the pleasure and then falling down again and getting up and all that. And that's then what finally allows us to go, oh, yeah, right, I get it. It's this life. You have to go through the journey, the effort of trying to figure it out. You can't know before it has started, you know, where it's going to go. And even if at the end you find out that, yeah, it really is a mountain after all, you wouldn't have known that if you hadn't have gone through the experience of grappling with it all for yourself and what it's really like for you. So, Zazen is more than a meditation posture, more than any set of particular techniques. It's not a way to escape from life by being mindful of something that is apart from the human world, as Katagiri pointed out, but is the practice of being present in the real stream of time and looking directly at life itself. Zazen enables you to plunge below the surface and leads you to touch the core of your life. Somewhat early on, Catherine also said to me, you know, your life depends on this practice. I had no idea what she meant. I did not like that either. She said, your life depends on this practice. Man. I think maybe I'm only just starting to open up to what that might mean. Maybe that's a subject for another talk. Because it's 7:17, so it would be a good time to hear if there's anything that's been stirred for you as you've been listening. Any reflections or questions that you have about your own journey in being present in the real stream of time and looking directly at your life and plunging below the surface to touch the core of your life.
For me, it's definitely a kind of a body practice, and I think one of the transformative parts of practice in the beginning for me was when I stopped separating myself, this imagined person, and I just started to accept who I was, even though that was sometimes uncomfortable. But that's when I started feeling whole, and that's when I started feeling joy, which is something I didn't really experience so much before. So it's that inclusiveness. It's not out there for me. You know, there's a saying that I thought of one time, so how's the sick mind heal itself? You know, it's when you're sick and you're trying to find this paradigm, this imagined character, that doesn't really exist. You have to start somewhere, and you have to start with what's happening with you in your present moment, not out there. So to me, it starts here, you know. And Zazen gives me the strength and the upright feeling to face it, to not move forward or move away. And so I find it very somatic for me. And, you know, it's a lot of things, you know, but it's really this inclusiveness of accepting your life and who you are. It's your life. You're not going to be Thich Nhat Hanh. You're not going to be Dalai Lama. You know, it's like it's you. and this is where it's at. So trying to be something I'm not, this is ridiculous. And I do that. I still, you know, want to be something, some ideal idea of a practitioner. But then I get embarrassed when I find out what I'm doing. And then I go back and I start feeling who I am, and I feel more complete. I forget about that, and I go back to this, you know, this paradigm of what other people are doing, you know. But
yeah.
It doesn't work that way.
Yeah.
Putting a head above a head.
Yeah.
So to speak. So.
Yeah, and you're saying that you've experienced that there's joy in that.
Yeah, it's poignant to feel both joy. It's that mixture of pain and acceptance, and it sensitizes you. It makes you feel alive.
Yeah.
And that's where I think you start feeling joy.
Yeah.
Rather than just kind of like happiness, which I find kind of like superficial.
Yeah, joy.
Joy is much more deeper because it can be, you can feel suffering,
yes,
but you don't get overwhelmed by it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it sounds, as you're talking, I'm just, certain phrases are coming to mind. There's that phrase that we said in the beginning, tasting the truth of the Tathagata. Tasting the truth is the term that comes up as I'm listening to you. It's not about happy, sad. It's your truth. And you're tasting it directly. So there is a kind of a liberative experience that comes from that.
Yeah, I can't practice your practice.
Yeah.
You can only practice where I'm coming from.
Yeah.
And I can borrow from your example.
Yeah.
But I always have to go back here.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Touching the core of your own life. Yeah. And yet we always are trying to encourage each other. That's why we come here. Try to talk about this stuff. Thank you, Kim. Yeah.
What you were talking about, like the little voice in the head, for me it's really critical of myself, and kind of what you were talking about too, like sort of being critical of yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And then my thought process is they do create objects where I start thinking, and I think I just make it up in my mind that other people are thinking critically of me, and it's something that I've dealt with like all my life, but at least I'm aware of it. But I find that doing zazen is a way of sort of just being here, free from all fear, free from any criticism of myself, or feeling that others are being critical. And then just doing the chanting that we do in the morning, just all together, and just sort of just, you know, just letting it all go and just letting the words flow is really creates a really peaceful feeling, and I'm able to just carry that with me more and more, and it's helping me to just let go of those thoughts that come and start attacking.
Wonderful. But it's hard. Mary just, you know, it's hard. And I want to acknowledge, you know, that this extolling the virtues and benefits of zazen. I mean, I will do it until the day I die, but I also want to do that with the admittance and the acknowledgement of what a difficult path it's been for me and how, important it has been to have the support of a place and community and a teacher and teachers who, companions, who students, who help us, encourage us along the way. Yeah, Mary.
It's hard to believe I'm saying this, but I, like everybody else in this room, I've been looking at myself, but for 75 years, on who I'm going to be. Okay, not much time left.
Yes.
So I guess who I'm going to be is probably who I am. Oh my. That's a lot to work on.
Isn't there something about getting towards the later years where that really does start becoming really evident? Mm-hmm. Right?
The, yeah, you get with a 2x4.
Yeah. All right.
The next, you know, is one foot, not right, Mary. actually I'm so neglect too, that we have a lot to learn. And actually we're learning it faster and smarter now than we ever did. I guarantee that.
But I do, yes, and I do appreciate the wake-up call that it can be to start getting older. Because, you know, it is easier to just figure, oh, yeah, I got all the time in the world, and, you know, or just that whole thing of, you know, yeah, well, when I get my real job, or when I grow up, when I get my real job, you know, when I get my whatever. And then at some point, you know, you just have to realize that this is it. This is it. This is our life. And how beautiful that there's people for 2,000 years who've been, you know, working this stuff and stirring this pot, and that we can come here and draw from it and drink, you know, eat the soup, be nourished by the soup of people who make this effort to actually touch the core of your life. You know, I'm so moved by that. That's always moved me. That's what's kept me in the game. You know, when I get cynical about people, and I do, I get very cynical about people. I am cynical about people. And at the very same time, I'm also moved and, you know, just profoundly moved and optimistic. At the very same time, both are true. But when I feel the encouragement, it's when I realize how many people are really sincerely making the effort to touch the truth of our lives and to work for the well-being of others. I mean, we were just talking about it this morning. Jean and I often in the morning will say, well, you know, have you read the news yet? You know, give me the summary. It's like it's too much for both of us to read it because it's so bizarre. But so what, any changes? And just realizing, though, how much, you know, and I know this is a cliche, but it's really true. The news we get is all the bad stuff. And, you know, do we get the news about all the people who are plunging below the surface and touching the core of their lives and waking up every single day to go out and do good, and maybe not every day, but when we can. Mm-hmm. And not to forget that. And to put ourselves in contact with information that will communicate that and reinforce that for us so that we don't give up on each other. Yes.
I've been considering gut feeling.
Gut feeling. Mm-hmm.
Gut feeling. And I know what you mean, and I experience it. And there is a body dialogue that when I really pay attention, it's right on. But President Trump says he always operates on gut feeling.
Well, I guess it's not a universal wisdom source then, huh?
That's
right.
Well, that's what I'm considering. You know, yeah. What goes into that feeling?
Yeah.
You can be.
Yeah. Or what? Yeah.
Wisdom.
Yeah.
But it can also just be a pool.
Yeah.
All kinds of crap.
Yeah, that's a great point. It can be a fermenting pool of you know what.
I do.
Yeah.
Up to 75. I'm 85.
Well, yeah, and I mean, and that, I think that's, excuse me, I just got a leg cramp. So I'm going to be very ungracious and just, you know, none of this is absolute, and I think that's always, I really appreciate you bringing that up. It's not like the gut feeling is holy. You know what I mean? I think that, yeah, I mean, how do we ever know really what to listen to and what to be guided by? And, you know, probably there's a really, in his case, it would be good to have to throw in a little logic, right? A little compassion, a little intelligence. I mean, there are other realms that are very important in life to follow. So I agree. I agree with that. But I just, I don't know, just thinking from my own experience and how much wisdom there is when we allow ourselves to go down and touch in with what's really going on. And Catherine used to say, the body is the deepest thought. So I don't know how that applies to our dear president, but I think he's sort of a mystery in that regard. But consider, perhaps, that body is the deepest thought. This is such an awkward position. Get proper again.
And you're listening to your body.
Well, when I get these certain kinds of leg cramps, it's like a spasm, and I can't do anything about it.
Mm-hmm.
Trying to. Yes, last word, Patrice.
Just following on Corinne, and one of the things that I've often worked with and wondered about in this practice and in other internal practices that I have is not everything that arises from within, Corinne is saying, is really an instinct or a gut feeling. And some impulses are not necessarily harmless or wholesome. Or it's just a working with that, because a lot, pretty much everything comes from within. So I was just wondering about your own practice and your own process and sort of discerning those voices.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not everything is just like to be shut out, but not everything just like, oh, that's coming from my gut, it must be trustworthy.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
But how do you work with that?
Well, I think that's a good question. So a couple things. One is when I first started really being interested in this practice of tuning, going down, rather than I was trying to work it on up here, but to actually go down and listen, was I worked with, is what's happening going towards opening or closing? Is it going towards releasing or constricting? And Buddha offers us wholesome or unwholesome. Mm-hmm. You know, in the early teachings of the Buddha, there's that. So there's distinctions. That's wisdom, you know, the wisdom side, making distinctions. And so I think that for myself, it gets more nuanced and subtle as I get more familiar with these different characters and these different functions, where I can recognize, I get more intimate with it, so I can recognize maybe, oh, that's a fear twinge, and that's one of those, you know, that's my old mind trying to butt in and make me pay attention to my pain body. That's actually my old mind trying to agitate my pain body. So it's not like now I'm going to be completely at the effect of that and let it hijack me, right? Mm-hmm. But what I'm doing is I'm using, as part of the information that I'm bringing in, is my somatic awareness and not just the conceptual. Mm-hmm. I think that's probably one of the biggest things for me about the four domains is the resources, bringing in the emotional and the cognitive and the somatic and the transpersonal, all as resources to then make this discernment that only, you know, that there is no ultimate answer, but I think the right direction shows up in more wholesomeness and more feeling of ease. And, you know, I think that's kind of the feedback system that we can look for. What's your experience with that?
Just listening. I think it's, you know, one thing that, you know, over the years, we do learn ourselves over time. We sort of learn our little dictionaries and our little thesauruses and our little trick, you know, like when you said it's tricksy, I think, you know, yeah, that's what Gollum said. It's tricksy.
Yeah.
It is tricksy.
It is tricksy.
It has its own little tricks.
It's yeah.
It's good to learn what's tricksy.
Yeah, it's good to learn what's tricksy.
It's a lot of, going over it and over it and learning from your own experiences.
And pay attention to what happens. Yeah, I mean, the cause and effect, you know, what's the impact of it? What happens when I do this? Yeah. What happens when I do that? What happens if I listen and act on it? What happens if I don't? And then I think we start getting more...
And that's tricksy, too.
Yeah. It's all tricksy.
It is. The Dharma of Gollum.
There we go. On that note, we will close for tonight. So thank you all for coming and participating. Mm-hmm. By your presence and your words and your effort and your companionship over the years. And even if you just showed up for the first time tonight. Okay, then. Beings are numberless.
I vow to save them. Illusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. The dust rays unsurpassable.